Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM, and we are back with Mike Charm. But this time, it is not ATLS. Instead, it's going to be all about the changes with BLS, ACLS, and PALS. So, Mike, first off, thank you for doing our show notes, as always, because it makes life much easier for me, because then I just get to talk and then edit out all the stuff that we didn't want to talk about in the middle of a podcast. So, how are you doing today?
Good. I'm thrilled to listen to you talk.
Okay, we're going to do this in some kind of organized fashion, because don't be like us for the last 3 hours having talked about other things and not recording this podcast. And I wish I was joking, but we're on hour three of doing this. But we've got this organized in a way where we're going to talk about BLS, ACLS, and PAL separately. It's worth noting that with the 2020 updates, there are things that are good, there are things that are bad, there are things that just make you like, kind of scratch your head a little bit. And we're going to try our best to not dive too much in the weeds, because you could with just about every single individual issue. But we're going to talk about the key changes, some of the things that may be worth kind of addressing, that at least saying, hey, this is a controversy. And then the big thing, if you're just listening to this podcast, you are not finding us on the totalem.org page, which, by the way, totalem.org, go there. Look at the show notes, because you will find all sorts of goodness. And especially in this case, we're going to include all the algorithms, which hopefully the AHA doesn't get upset by, because they have this all publicly released anyway. And we're just trying to help save lives, AHA. So please don't sue us. All right, moving on.
Yeah, I mean, it's free content. Like you said, all these things we're referring today are free content. They're not behind a paywall. We are just sharing it. Of course, we're citing AHA as the source. So yeah, I think we're good, legally speaking.
Yay. All right. So let's talk about first, I think the most important thing of all, CPR.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to talk a lot about different things. And as we were discussing, if you do all those other things right, as far as you nail your medication times and you are spot on with regards to, oh, let's say, using ultrasound to do certain things, all that stuff is for naught if you bork it on doing good old-fashioned CPR. And what these 2020 changes to emergency cardiovascular care talk about when they talk to the instructors, hey, you're teaching this new change throughout any course you do, BLS, ACLS, PALS, the emphasis must be on the components of high-quality CPR, because AHA knows how important this is, and how if it's messed up, that's how people get hurt. And if it's done well, that's how you get ROS. That's how you have good neurological outcome at discharge to wherever you go. So what are those components of high-quality CPR? Compressing at a rate of 100 to 120 beats per minute, adequate compression depth based on the kind of patient you have in front of you, and good full chest recoil. You want what's called a high chest compression fraction. So there are certain metrics for that you're going to learn when you yourself go through your recertification here. But the general idea is you don't want to be off of that person's chest for more than 10 seconds in a row. And it's nice to have some sort of a device measuring that metric. We're going to get into metrics and how they can be monitored later on here. And lastly, of course, early defibrillation. If someone's in a shockable rhythm, you want to get juice into them as fast as possible. And I think the guidelines do a good job of balancing when you do defibrillation versus when you give drugs and when each should be emphasized. And Chip, we're going to get into that as we move along here.
So it's not just stable medicine, unstable Edison. Going back to my EMS roots here for a second.
That's a part of it, but yeah.
So a quick definition thing here real quick. ROSC, in case you are new and maybe you're going to get your certification in and you're trying to just figure out like what's changed with your old book that you have that someone handed down to you. ROSC is return of spontaneous circulation. That is what we're going to be talking about today. And the other thing that I want to talk about that was really a given for most of us, but I think just worth saying here real quick, is that you have to identify these people early and, you know, get help early on. So we kind of laugh about that a lot of times when we're doing our recertification courses and, you know, it's like tap, tap, Annie, are you okay? Did I just date myself a little bit with Annie there, but checking the patient and like, hey, call the code team or whatever. But it really is an important part, because you need to get everything rolling as quickly as possible. And so, yes, those are the kind of little things that sometimes we kind of overplay because it helps remind us that that's a basic concept. But high quality CPR, early defibrillation had the best number needed to treat the NNT of anything out there. So as Mike's saying, everything else is just bonus. Let's talk about some changes here. And I think we kind of narrowed it down to, you know, roughly five key changes in each, sometimes more, sometimes less, but kind of Ken Milne style, I guess we'll combine or remove as we need to. Number one was the fact that the adult and pediatric chain of survival has changed a little bit. So what's going on there, Mike?
People, if you're familiar, if you've looked at one of these flip books or manuals before, you've seen that graphic of the chains of survival, the important stuff. And we've mentioned a couple of them already. There is now a new link in every single chain, and the link is recovery. And why that's emphasized is that ROSC is just the end of the beginning for this patient. Like, you got them to ROSC. That's awesome. We all like hug and cheer and whatever else. And, that's just the start. Like, you move on to the next patient, but the patient now has its own or her own road to go down. And so the new course goes into more detail. There's a good algorithm as far as all the different things you need to go over with regards to post-ROSC care. And this is things like temperature management, if that's applicable, things like maintaining good respiratory parameters, hemodynamic parameters. So it's all there. It's a lot of numbers. Go to that part of your smart book and manual. Just know that it's being more emphasized in 2020 AHA, ACLS, BLS, PALS.
I do want to mention one thing about TTM or targeted temperature management, because it used to be about having these patients hypothermic, like making them nice and cold, talking about temperatures down to 32 degrees Celsius. The now recommendations and kind of a bit of a change is the fact that they're talking about 32 to 36 degrees Celsius. Remember that the normal body temperature is around 37 degrees Celsius. The reason why, because this comes up a lot when I'm talking about this to nurses or colleagues in general, is that you're trying to prevent the hyperthermia. Fever on the brain, especially when you're talking about post-cardiac arrest care, is extremely detrimental. And we are able to see that with the evidence that we have. And so the big thing is, it's not necessarily about how low can you go. It's as much as preventing them from going up. And so the idea about if you bring their temperature down is you have more wiggle room. So when they do start going up in temperature, you've got a little bit of a buffer there. All right, so let's move on to the next point here. And that's about adult rescue breathing. There's kind of a subtle change, but it's still an important one because I think it keeps it a little bit easier for us to keep track of.
Yeah, there were all these different ranges before as far as when you have this kind of airway, you're going to do one breath every 5 to 6 seconds. If you have this other kind of airway, you're going to do one breath every 6 to 8 seconds. Well, look, what's the common number here? It's six, okay? So you can just do one rescue breath every 6 seconds, regardless of the kind of airway you have, and you're still hitting the old ways of doing things, so to speak. It's just an easier way to think about things. So you're kind of cognitively offloading a little bit and not having to stress about all these different ranges. It's one breath every 6 seconds, and that's just nice and simple and something that's easy to remember.
Combining the old ways with the new, I see. My Game of Thrones reference there.
or just explaining it simpler. Yeah.
All right. So number three is going to be about infant compressions. And again, we're in BLS changes here. So you may notice that we switched from adult and pediatric to adult to now infant. And that's because there are some changes that are going on here. So infant compressions, what's happening?
We have some options here when we want to give compressions to infants. So now there's three acceptable options here. So you can use two fingers in one hand to the sternum just below the nipple line. So just below the nipple line. So two fingers from one hand. If that's not working well for you, or it's just easier, then you can use two thumbs. So two encircling hands, two thumbs, one on each hand clearly, and you're compressing the sternum just below the nipple line. Well, what if for whatever reason, it's hard to get that depth that you want? Again, you want to have good chest compression depth. It's important. That's an important part of CPR. What you're trying to do in infants is achieve depth of 1/3 of the chest diameter. So for whatever reason, your hands are too weak or the baby is too thick or whatever, then you can use also the heel of one hand. And you may be able to compress the child's chest easier that way than using two fingers or two thumbs. So two fingers, two thumbs, heel of one hand. The goal is get to that depth of 1/3 of the chest diameter for these infants.
And honestly, the two-finger compression gets kind of exhausting after a little while. Just like finger strength-wise, it can be rather uncomfortable. So I like the fact that they've given more flexibility. And you may think to yourself, well, the two encircling thumbs thing was there before. Yes, but not for one rescuer. That's the change here. Before, that was a two-rescuer method. And I think the idea is to help cut down and save time. But then again, if you're not giving good compressions because you're not getting good depth there and good recoil, like we were just talking about, it doesn't matter about that slight delay that could be potentially there, because if you're not giving good chest compressions at all, then you're not really doing anything helpful for this patient.
This is one of those times where effectiveness is more important than efficiency. You know, it's not about how fast, it's about how well.
Yes, absolutely. All right, moving on, pediatric ventilation rates. So this is another kind of a little bit of a subtle change, but an important one that also carries with it a little bit of controversy. So what's the overarching principle? What's the thing that is new, Mike?
Yeah, I'll give what the party line is, and then you can talk about what the controversy is, if that's cool. What the manual is saying now, what the AHA is saying now, that in kids, you're giving one breath every 2 to 3 seconds. And that's really fast if you think about it compared to how we used to do things, okay? These are patients with a pulse or who are getting CPR with an advanced airway, one breath every 2 to 3 seconds. Now, where does this come from? It's a big change, especially with how we talk about how excess ventilation can compromise our hemodynamics here. There was one multi-center observational trial that showed that people who were accidentally ventilating faster than recommended back in the day, that it actually resulted in improved survival to hospital discharge for these infants. And so AHA recognized that. They said, wow, this, by mistake, these kids are doing better with this increased ventilation rate. So they went ahead and gave that recommendation here. But Chip, we were kind of looking before the podcast about where that came from and wondering if that's the best thing to do at this point, considering the level of evidence.
Yeah, so this erupted on social media almost as soon as this was published, and for good reason. I don't want to dive too far into this because this can get kind of complicated really quickly. But to summarize, this was a study of 47 pediatric ICU patients in total. And that's not a very big number. And I get that pediatric rest is not as common, but when we're talking about a single in-hospital study and we're trying to transfer this now to pediatric out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, these are different patient populations. We've talked about this before when we've had changes with in-hospital cardiac arrest versus out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, because these are different patient populations, different situations. So yes, there may be some crossover, but this gets a little bit questionable for that. But also, we've seen in other studies that there may be signal for concern there, and that what happens and where the concern becomes is that this excess ventilation, so the fact that you're doing essentially 20 to 30 breaths per minute versus what was kind of more considered at 12 breaths per minute, is that you're going to increase the pressure in the chest, the intrathoracic pressure. You'll increase intracranial pressure. You'll decrease venous return. All the things that we worry about with cardiac arrest, and why some people talk about like never using PEEP valves or stuff like that in cardiac arrest either. This all has bad kind of juju there when we're thinking about like why is this occurring. But this study, like I said, it's a little more complicated than meets the eye. It's rather limited. I don't think it's really high quality to start with, but that was enough to make a change, even though, as we're going to talk about here in a little bit, even major, well-done, randomized controlled trial studies that are blinded and placebo didn't get the time of day that it should have to make major changes. So it's kind of one of those things that I'm not overly convinced by it. I mean, it is something that is coming up. I'm going to be curious if we can get follow-up studies to see how this actually factors in real life, and if we're finding that this is going to lead to negative outcomes versus positive outcomes. But like I said, I'm very curious to see what happens longer term, just because there is not strong evidence here, but that is what AHA is currently recommending.
Yeah, it's funny you came to that conclusion. I did the same thing. It's like there are all these bigger studies, and the end result is AHA saying, we need more information before we make an official change. Meanwhile, you have this one small, even though it's multi-center, small in-hospital population, and now you're making this change to all populations. It's a really weird way they are evaluating this data, and I don't know if they're valuing it the way that it should be valued.
So moving on to something that I'm sure is less controversial, and that's going to be the opioids. So with BLS, now we're actually talking about naloxone. I think it's actually kind of nice that they brought this up on the BLS side, because more and more and more people are getting access to naloxone. I know that this can be a philosophical, ethical debate. We're not here to talk about that part, but instead talking about like something I think was actually a good point to bring up. And an important change was about adding naloxone, the dosing, and when not to give it. If you can talk just a little bit about that, I'm going to add in a little extra.
And they kind of refined the algorithm with regards to opioid-associated emergencies here and how you handle that. When you have somebody with a pulse, they have a pulse, right? But they are not breathing or they have agonal respirations, like not adequate ventilation here. These are patients where you give them naloxone and then you give them rescue breaths. They have a pulse, right? What's their problem? Well, they're in sort of a respiratory arrest. So let's fix the respiratory thing and support everything else. Contrast that to someone who has no pulse and no breathing. What does that sound like? That sounds like cardiac arrest. So what do you do for cardiac arrest? You start CPR and you do all the things we do with CPR. And if you suspect that opioids are involved, then you consider, that's their phrase, you consider naloxone when you're ready to do that. But the theme that we want to hit throughout this thing is, look, the drugs you give are less important than early recognition, early initiation of CPR, and high-quality CPR. So don't get it twisted when, oh, this is an opioid overdose, I give naloxone and I wait. Not when there's no pulse and no breathing.
This is something that, I mean, they did put consider, and I think it's something that's reasonable to at least consider it. But realistically, if they are in cardiac arrest and you're giving naloxone, most likely, with what evidence seems to be out there, probably not going to get ROSC because you gave them naloxone. It's going to be because you gave them adequate oxygenation and ventilation versus the drug was the thing that fixed it. That, and along with your high-quality CPR and early recognition, as Mike is mentioning. So the other part with this is, okay, so now we know when we should give or consider giving naloxone, what dosing. And it's kind of a broad range. So if you're not as familiar with this, maybe this is something that is something you don't see all the time. They talk about giving 0.4 to 2 milligrams of naloxone every 2 to 3 minutes. You can think, well, that's a big range. And it is. As Mike and I were talking about before we started hitting the record button here was, okay, when do you do this and how much and at what time? Mike and I are kind of on the same page about this. I think some slight differences in opinion, but not a ton. And keep in mind, these are individual practices, right? So you may have something different at your institution or a different way you handle this, but generally maybe better to give more if this person is truly apneic. They still have a pulse, but they're apneic or very agonal respirations. They're not ventilating well, then probably going to go with that 2 milligrams first. But once they start acting like they're responding, cutting that down to 0.4. And I think there's lots of great different strategies as far as how to do this, whether you give them like a slow titration drip where you're still in the room, you're still managing them. And as soon as they start getting better to a point that you feel comfortable with, turning that off and then realizing that over the next couple of minutes, the rest of that medicine through first pass and whatnot will actually get better and more of it will be absorbed and you'll start seeing some general improvement, but they won't have such blockage of their receptors that next thing you know, they wake up very upset, vomiting, withdrawing. Like that's the whole thing we're trying to avoid here, right, Mike?
Yeah, we're just trying to get them too sleepy. We don't want to take them past sleepy to punching, right? We're trying to avoid punching of anybody here. And I feel like we're talking about this too, is that like sometimes naloxone is almost given as a punishment by some people, like, check this out. This is what I'm going to do to this person here. Number one, it's not good patient care because we're not trying to make the patients more agitated. That's not what is associated with good outcomes in patient care. And number two, we're trying to keep the staff safe because these are patients that can get pretty agitated and pretty violent here. And so like, when you're giving these unnecessary big boluses of naloxone here, I think that you have to question why that's happening. And are you really doing the right thing by everybody in the room by doing that, sometimes not.
Okay, now let's move on to ACLS, Mike. So we're going to talk about kind of more seven key points here that I think was kind of the main things here. And the first one is going to be about epinephrine, because why not? It's controversial. Let's go for it.
Yeah, let's just dive right in here. And, you know, we're all familiar, or at least we should be, with the Paramedic 2 trial about epinephrine and when you use it and how effective it really is. And is it really helping in terms of good neurointact survival here? So we're going to just sidestep all that stuff here. And what we are going to talk about is how the cardiac arrest algorithm for adults has changed and where they're emphasizing things. So they're kind of doing this kind of bidirectional emphasis here. There's probably a better way to explain that. But what I mean to say is this: they really focus on giving early epinephrine for a non-shockable rhythm, which makes sense, right? You can't shock these people. Shocking is not the priority. Let's give epi, and hopefully that seems to help, in addition to, of course, our high-quality CPR, right? The other direction of this fork is that they're actually making more of a fine point to hold epinephrine in our shockable rhythms until after the second shock. And I think what they're trying to say there is, look, it's not that you can't give epinephrine earlier if all your ducks are in a row and you have plenty of staff and everything else is just rolling. It's not that you can't give epi earlier. It's just that these other things are more of a priority. Go ahead and give two shocks if you can, as fast as possible, as fast as recommended here. And don't worry about epinephrine until those things are great, that you've optimized your CPR and you've optimized your ability to defibrillate.
And this actually does come a bit from evidence from the Paramedic 2 trial. And if you still aren't sure about what we're talking about with the Paramedic 2 trial, no problem. We have a previous podcast on it. Check it out in the show notes portion, as always, on totalem.org to catch that information. But the other thing is, actually, this is already in the European guidelines. This is AHA trying to catch up as far as the difference between shocking and putting the emphasis on that defibrillation early versus earlier use of epinephrine. So I do find that interesting. We're going to avoid going too far into the controversy side because it has been talked about before. It is a little frustrating that such a high quality study was essentially ignored because, hey, it brought more bodies back versus no significant change in neurologically intact survival. All right, moving on to the adult bradycardia management here. So let's kind of hit that one for a quick second.
This is a big change. Now it's being recommended to give atropine in 1 milligram dosing. Of course, the dosing used to be 0.5 milligrams before. Now the recommendation is go right to 1 milligram. There are some more personalized, more provider preference changes as far as how you can do atropine. And some people are saying you can even give more atropine if they don't respond to one, or maybe you start with less and you don't just give the same dose over and over and over again, one after one after one. There's more to learn clearly beyond just what's in the ACLS manual, but this is kind of the floor of the standard of care here, is start with a higher dose. Let's switch tracks to dopamine. So dopamine and bradycardia dosing used to be 2 to 20 micrograms per kilogram. It is now, again, a higher dose. Now we're starting off at the floor of 5 micrograms per kilogram, and the ceiling dose is still 20 micrograms per kilogram. So now the dosing range is 5 to 20 micrograms per kilogram.
So another kind of subtle change, I mean, the bradycardia part was a bit of a change in the dosing. They still include dopamine, but just realize that a third option is still epinephrine, if you're like me and not a huge dopamine fan. But ACS, they did have a subtle change here, and it's truly subtle, but I think is, again, a terminology change that may be worthwhile. So what's that?
Right. We used to talk about door to balloon time, right? That's our metric, door to balloon time. If someone is going to go to the cath lab, they need to go from hitting your emergency department door to in the cath lab being stented within 90 minutes here. What AHA is emphasizing is a different metric, medical contact to balloon time. And by medical contact, I mean the first trained rescuer. So when EMS pulls up on scene of someone who needs to be having PCI, that's when our clock starts with medical contact to balloon time. So for us in-hospital clinicians here, I guess that means we have to really be on our game with regards to transferring somewhere that can do PCI and rapidly if we are not at a place that can do PCI. And then for our out-of-hospital clinicians, it's important that they recognize, hey, it's really important where we take this person. We shouldn't just go to any old ER. We need to go somewhere where the cath lab is up and running and we can roll them hopefully straight to the cath lab if we do a STEMI activation from the field, which is why we're doing a cath on this person in the first place, right? We're suspecting a STEMI, a big old heart attack versus just an NSTEMI.
Just for language sake, and I'm hoping that this will eventually catch on and AHA will run with this. I'm not expecting them to change because of this podcast, but with enough voices, maybe this will carry forward. And that's the fact that STEMI is helpful. Like, it is one type of occlusive MI, but there are false positive reasons, such as even benign early repolarization or pericarditis, which I've seen multiple times. My colleagues or others who have called that a STEMI and then it's not the case, or you get the opposite of you have quote unquote STEMI equivalents, which are really just other forms of occlusive MIs that you can have EKG changes for. And I think it's really important that we recognize that we need to pay attention to not just one type of pathology, but that may be a little extra as well. But I think it's something that we need to start recognizing more and more. STEMI is just one type of pathology that warrants a cath lab.
I think there's a lot of great reading out there for people who are interested in diving deeper into what the next thing should be. And I think the next paradigm coming is, if I'm remembering it right, OMI and NOMI, right? Well, or OMI is occlusive myocardial infarction and NOMI is a non-occlusive myocardial infarction. And so NOMI is kind of going to be the new name for NSTEMI, and OMI is going to be the catch-all term for ST elevation myocardial infarction and all those equivalents that we talk about that still need to go to the cath lab here. So just, you know, look out there for OMI and NOMI. There's a blog called Dr. Smith's ECG blog where he goes on a big manifesto about this. It's literally called the OMI manifesto or something like that. A really smart emergency clinician here who does a lot of great free teaching on EKGs. A good person if you want to up your EKG game or ECG game if you'd like to play that game instead. But look up Dr. Smith's ECG blog.
Moving on to another thing that has been relatively new, kind of getting hot in emergency medicine world, is double sequential defibrillation.
Right. That's the concept where if one shock is good, is two shocks better? And so you get two monitors, two sets of pads on a patient, and you shock with both monitors at the same time. Right now, the evidence is still being developed here. And so what AHA officially says is that teams may consider this strategy. They're not giving a situation in which the strategy of double sequential defibrillation is optimal or recommended. It's just something, a part of the tools on your tool belt. And I bet as time goes on, there'll be more recommendation as far as when this is a better approach. There's also some talk about, hey, sometimes instead of shocking with more, you need to shock in a better direction. You need to direct the electricity a little bit better. And so this comes with adjusting pads and changing the flow of electricity to the patient's heart.
So actually, that is a very nice segue to what I was going to say. One thing is that we have talked about DSD, you know, dual sequential or double sequential defibrillation before, and that's also going to be in the show notes. But as Mike alluded to, and I think the strategy that works well and something that I'm doing is that, say EMS comes in with the patient in one pad position, then what we'll do is we'll put the opposite type of pads on there if they have had lack of success in the field. And so what they'll do is maybe they'll have that right upper left lower chest set up. Well, we're going to do anterior posterior and we'll see if just simply us switching those works. And then if that's not successful, then we'll actually keep, because we'll have kept both sets of pads on, now we'll do the dual sequential. And so we usually do two attempts of one, two attempts of the other, and then we'll start doing both. And that's kind of helps filter out the patients that don't really need DSD.
Another thing that is getting increased utilization is intraosseous access when we're trying to give parenteral medications here. What the official AHA guidance in 2020 is that IV access is the preferred route of medication administration. Now, there are some studies that suggest that IO meds have decreased efficacy. But here's the tricky part, right? None of these involved nice randomized control trials. And I mean, an IO line is not an IO line is not an IO line. There's different kinds of IOs. There's plenty of different sites to do IOs. And so I think that there's a lot more research that needs to be done as far as, is there an IO line that is better than other IO lines in terms of ACLS? And so how does that optimal IO route compare to IV access, in addition to the logistics of how fast it is to get IO? What AHA, again, officially is saying is that it believes it is reasonable for teams to first attempt IV access. But as is often the case, when IV attempts are unsuccessful or getting IV access is otherwise just not going to happen for this patient, there is a weaker recommendation for the teams to consider establishing an IO. Now, you know, when it comes to my experience in Afghanistan, I started my PA career as a military PA, and I ran trauma teams in Afghanistan for a little under a year here. That was kind of the strategy we came up with here, is that we had medics and they were tasked with getting the IV on the patient because we wanted to give meds IV if we could. I gave the medics two good tries. And if they couldn't get it in two tries as we were doing the rest of the resuscitation efforts here, then we were going to do an IO and we're going to move on, because just like in cardiac arrest, there are more important things to do and to optimize than medication administration. And what is it? It's our great CPR and it's our early defibrillation when the patient is in a shockable rhythm.
Now I get to move on to one of my favorite things, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to make this an entirely separate podcast. So I'm going to briefly mention this, and that is POCUS, point of care ultrasound, which if you have listened to this any length of time, you know I love. And they basically said that you can use it to identify the H's and T's and sometimes for ROSC, but overall the AHA recommends against using it for prognostication and determining futility.
Here we go.
I can see what they were going for here, and I am also going to say I'm relatively in the same boat as far as, like, it can be very helpful to determine ROSC, and usually you're going to be able to determine ROSC otherwise, but it can help there when there are subtle cases or you're not sure. It can also help identify for pathologies that are reversible, especially when you perform a rush exam. So we're not just looking at the heart anymore. But if I have someone who we've been doing CPR for a while, and I have asystole consistently, no cardiac activity on the monitor, no cardiac motion on the ultrasound, I feel much more comfortable calling that patient versus if I didn't have that. And I have also had plenty of times now where it's come up where someone was quote unquote asystole and they were in fine ventricular fibrillation, or I've also used POCUS for the benefit of redirecting chest compressions, because I could tell that the chest compressions while having the ultrasound in place was over the left ventricular outflow tract. And so if I'm pushing over that, I'm probably not going to get blood to circulate through the body like I need it to. So redirecting to actually push over the part of the chest that's beneficial, which may not always match up anatomically with where we'd be told to put our chest compressions, that can make a huge difference. And I don't necessarily have strong evidence to say that, yes, this does indeed lead to strong beneficial outcomes. What I can tell you is that there is signal for that. I would love to see more evidence of it, but I think the AHA may have overstepped a little bit with this call, but that is officially what they're saying. I kept myself pretty tame there.
No lie, I really am feeling this, and I'm not saying this just because it's on your podcast here, but I really am feeling this burning desire to go to a practical POCUS course and get smart on POCUS, because you know what you went into there is just next level with in terms of how do we optimize CPR, and which is so key here. And so it's fascinating that you can use POCUS to do that as well.
Exactly. And like I said, I'm kind of holding myself back here a little bit on this, but I think it's something that we'll talk about more. And I know it's something that we talk about in practical POCUS courses, but before I get stuck on this, let's move on to the next topic.
Yeah, good. Exactly. Yeah, you don't want to be here half an hour later still, which I think we could be with your breadth of knowledge and depth of knowledge here. Pregnancy, total shift. So do CPR. That's the takeaway here is that, you know, I think it's understandable that certain populations of people, we may get a little oogie, for lack of a better word, about what do we do? Like, oh, this is a kid, or oh, it's a pregnant person, and there's all these other considerations here. There are some interesting studies that show just women in general get less out of hospital, so early CPR, than men. And we know how important early CPR is in terms of survivability here. And so I wonder if you've got not only a woman, but a woman who is clearly pregnant, how much more are non-clinician bystanders willing to jump on that chest? Well, listen, these people, when they are pulseless and apneic, are just as deserving and just as needing of high-quality CPR as anybody else who is not pregnant. So go ahead and do CPR, and don't be as concerned about what do I do with this protuberant belly in the way. If you have adequate rescuers and the fundus is at or above the umbilicus. So what does that mean in terms of the pregnancy here? Well, that means that generally when their fundus is at or above the umbilicus, the belly button, now we're talking about a baby that is 20 weeks or more along in gestation. And so that has different things to consider in terms of that baby's survivability after a CPR here. When the fundus is that high, if you have adequate rescuers, someone can perform left lateral uterine displacement. They are literally pushing the uterus to the left here. One other change that comes in pregnant women, in addition to doing CPR, if you can't get ROSC in a certain amount of time, now we're talking about 5 minutes as the number. It used to be four, now it's five. Then that's when you should be considering doing, and it really depends on your terminology and what you're trying to emphasize here, but within 5 minutes, if you can't get ROSC, you want to consider a perimortem cesarean delivery. And Chip, I want to throw it to you because we were talking about that interesting use of terminology here. There's a different way to think about this.
Yeah, so EM, more and more, we're talking about resuscitative hysterotomy, and I much prefer that because of the emphasis it carries, where when we think about perimortem, it's that, okay, mom's dead. This is a salvage operation of trying to get the fetus, when really resuscitative hysterotomy is we're actually working actively on both. And that also puts with it a certain weight of the fact that you need lots of help when you have these situations. This is not going to work as well in the areas where you have minimal staffing. This is something that's going to take two teams to really help with this. But also, this is something that, again, we're trying to help both the pregnant person and the fetus survive this. And sometimes you'll get really lucky and you might get both. Sometimes you may get one. And unfortunately, relatively common is you may get neither. But as emphasized here, if you start this process within the first 5 minutes, that is going to have the highest likelihood of success. So this is usually someone who's crashing right in front of you where this happens. And this also leads to another important point. I think the better way to think about this is not that you're going to, oh, it's been 5 minutes, now we should probably start thinking about this. It's you should think about this as soon as someone who's pregnant, who has a fundal height that's at least on the umbilicus. And the reason for that, by the way, it's not just about fetal viability, but it's also because if the fetus is that big, there's most likely pressure on the IVC that's preventing good venous return. So the idea is that if we take baby out, then we help reduce that issue. And so this is kind of like pushing the fundus off to the side, right? But now we've got it completely out of the way and we can better resuscitate the two. But this is something that as soon as this person's in arrest, you need to be thinking about this and starting to get prepped for it. Because great if everything goes back to normal, you've got good ROSC within those 5 minutes, you didn't need to do that. But if you are going to do it, you have to do it as quickly as possible for the best outcome.
I love the shifted emphasis, and I hope that we go to that new terminology in the next focus update, emphasizing the importance of caring for both of these patients and how both of these patients deserve a full shot at ROSC and at life. I love that change in terminology and change in emphasis that comes from the change in terminology. I want to be specific in what the guidelines say, and it kind of goes along with what Chip is saying, is that verbatim here, if no ROSC in 5 minutes, consider immediate perimortem cesarean delivery, or resuscitative hysterotomy here. What they're saying is what Chip is saying is that at 5:01, you start the procedure, not at 5 minutes you think about doing the procedure. You are considering it and you're ready to go at 5:01.
All right. So last thing that we're going to talk about here, just really quickly, is the debriefing of rescuers.
Boy, I think about my time in Afghanistan and my first trauma and my last trauma and how much better we were at treating trauma with our last patient. And I think that debriefings are a critically missed opportunity for us to improve our CPR efforts here. That's all we want, right? We want to get better every single time. And so these debriefings often don't happen because we work in busy emergency departments here. When there's time, well, heck, how about this? We need to make time for these debriefings. Number one, from a quality control standpoint. And number two, hey, sometimes these are emotional events. And so it's a good time to check in with your crew and look them in the eyes and say, hey, are you okay? Are you okay? Do you need a break? Do we need to talk more about the things that came to the surface when you're doing this from your personal perspective here? I think debriefings are critically a missed opportunity for improvement and for self-care in the ER.
Absolutely. And that's something else that we have talked about on the podcast before when it comes to debriefings. And what I really like is what's called the hot offload, which is the thing that you're going to do right away, because you're not going to have a full debrief and you probably really shouldn't have a full debrief right after a cardiac arrest. But there is a point of checking in on people, making sure people are okay to proceed, especially if you're talking about in the middle of a shift, and helping them right away versus sitting on that. But the second part is that it should be some way that we have a structured review and making sure that we're doing what we can to improve outcomes for the future and going through that process. So both types of debriefing styles, I think, are really important. I'm glad that they put something in there now as a recommendation.
We're going to move from adult to PALS, our pediatric advanced life support changes here. And there's only two big changes we want to go over right now. We did see in our reading that there are many other changes when it comes to things like managing the patient who is in septic shock, who is in hemorrhagic shock, and these things all kind of fall under the purview of PALS. We are going to sidestep those things and let you discover them during your PALS course. The things we want to talk about today, the first one is using cuffed endotracheal tubes for intubation here. And the official language from the AHA is that it is, quote, reasonable, close quotes, to choose cuffed endotracheal tubes over uncuffed ET tubes for intubating infants and children. The old guidance was that both cuffed and uncuffed were acceptable here. And I think the reasoning here is that cuffed tubes have their benefit of decreasing aspiration here. There was this worry previously that, hey, if you used a cuffed tube on a kid, you're going to get some subglottic, some stenosis of the airway here. And that is a pretty rare event we're finding out here. And so the risks of that are relatively few. And so that's why the push for the cuffed tubes over the uncuffed.
I'm actually kind of surprised it took this long for the AHA to bring up the fact of cuff tubes are preferred or at least reasonable to use. I have always used cuff tubes, and I think that's kind of the norm these days, but I'm glad that this is now something that's considered more routine.
I bet this is one of those things where skilled, experienced, do this day in, day out clinicians were already doing. It's just good to have it being the floor has raised, which is nice.
Yes. All right. Cricoid pressure.
I feel like that's another one of those things where it's like, wow, people are still doing this. But now the official language is routine use of cricoid pressure is not recommended during endotracheal intubation of pediatric patients. I don't even think they mention it at all in adult patients. But now they're officially saying we don't recommend this for pediatrics.
Yeah, this is sometimes where the pediatric literature takes a little bit longer to catch up with the adult side. Kind of for obvious reasons when you're talking about less literature to look at and to work from. So it is a little surprising that, hey, cricoid pressure just now comes up, but I'm glad that they took the time to mention it. I did want to mention something else that I found when I was going through this here that once again, just illustrates the fact of something that we're already doing with adults. Now they bring up with the pediatric side as well. And that is invasive blood pressure monitoring to assess for CPR quality. This is something that AHA has talked about with adults in the past, but it was kind of like slid under the radar, just like POCUS was and some other stuff. Like it wasn't emphasized in the actual courses. It's the reason why it's a good idea to look at the summaries that are published, because you'll find a lot more information. You'll actually see why they talk about the stuff they do. And they talked about that, hey, you can use the diastolic blood pressure as a way of assessing CPR quality when you're using continuous invasive arterial blood pressure monitoring. And this is something that really happens more in adults in high quality centers. I'll say like high functioning centers that are cardiac arrest centers of excellence, where you're doing that routinely. I wasn't aware of them doing it as much in pediatrics. And so to be able to see that now they're talking about, hey, we should work on this as a goal. And what they talk about is that with some new evidence, when they're using CPR quality based on the arterial line placement, that the rates of survival with favorable neurological outcomes were improved if the diastolic blood pressure was at least 25 millimeters mercury in infants and at least 30 millimeters mercury in children. So I just want to mention that because I found that kind of interesting. And the reason why the diastolic blood pressure, just kind of going back to our physiology and pathophysiology for a second, is because of the fact of the coronary vessels fill during diastole. And so if you have an adequate diastolic blood pressure to fill those coronary arteries, then you will help in achieving ROSC.
That's a great point. You know, there are a lot of other official changes that were made in 2020. And these we feel like are the most important ones that we want you to know going into your recertification. We're going to have to do it eventually, you know, in the next 2 years. So these are the ones we want you to focus on. There are many other finer points. We want to bring it right back around to the front here, to the top of our podcast, is that, yeah, all these things are great. But again, if you whiff it on providing high quality CPR and early defibrillation, you are really missing out on this patient's best opportunity to come back to spontaneous circulation and having a neurointact outcome. And so we wanted to close it off by talking about some interesting things that maybe you can do to help out achieve high quality CPR. And those things are CPR coaching and the use of a metronome. Chip, do you want to talk about CPR coaching? Do you do this? Does somebody do this? Is there a role for that officially in your ER when it comes to doing cardiac arrests?
Yeah, this was one of the things that, again, I was kind of surprised, I guess, that it wasn't brought up before. But at the same time, when I first heard it, I thought, well, this is kind of silly. And then I thought, no, really, this is actually something we're already doing. We're just now giving it a name and a role there. So it almost sounds silly. And when you go through your recertification and your update, you may think to yourself, like, there's really going to be someone standing there kind of just saying, push harder and faster. But really, this is something that helps, because prior to this new update, the idea was that your team leader is going to be the one who's going to encourage CPR quality. And a lot of us have feedback devices anyway, but that provides another cognitive burden. So instead, let's cognitively offload that from the team leader to someone else. And since doing that, I think it's a really good change. It's something that we should have been doing before, but now we actually have something that says, hey, this is a good idea. So I like it because it's something that we already talked about in a sense and we've already done, but now it's out there that this is indeed a recommendation.
It may be you work at a place where you have such a deep team that the team leader literally can just sit back a few feet off the bed and lead the team. But often you have less staff than you want, and that team leader is also trying to manage the airway and decide drugs and a lot of other things here. So yes, I've come to this conclusion kind of independently. And when I read it, when I was reviewing for this podcast and for my own recertification, which I just did recently, I was like, huh, there's actually stuff out there about CPR coaching and how it can help. And again, just to define what that means is that, yeah, it is somebody whose task it is to talk to the compressor and guide them and give them some gentle feedback, of course, using all the team dynamic stuff that AHA also pushes, which again, sounds fluffy, but I'm a huge believer as well in the importance of team dynamics in such an emotional, high stress environment. The next thing that was brought up is using a metronome. And so this metronome is, again, a way to help make sure that you are doing high quality CPR. You can get an app for your phone, and there's many out there, I am sure, and you can set the metronome to click at 110 beats per minute or 120 or whatever you choose to do, somewhere in that 100 to 120 range. There are studies on everything out there if you look hard enough. And so there actually are a couple of different studies out there showing that not necessarily that metronomes are definitively proven to improve ROSC, but they are for sure shown to help compressors hit that rate better. And so it stands to reason that it is a way that you can improve your odds of doing high quality CPR in general if you're managing that compression rate very well.
And actually, Mike, I think you gave me a shout out to that with the most recent podcast that you have done for the TwoView, because this was something that came up when you guys had kind of briefly talked about some of the ACLS updates and you weren't sure if there was some evidence out there. So I did a quick deep dive on it, found some stuff for you, sent it your way. But yeah, actually, we forgot to kind of mention this before, but you have a new podcast out there. You decided to branch out and spread your little wings and fly with Martha Roberts, right? So tell me about this TwoView podcast.
They have to be kind of big wings if they're going to lift me off the ground. But yeah, we have this podcast called The TwoView, and the subtitle is Emergency Medicine PAs and Ps. That is our focus, to talk about emergency medicine and talk about cutting edge practice in emergency medicine, getting you to that point with a focus on the PAs and NPs, because there are different issues about emergency medicine when it comes to being a PA and NP in that space that maybe don't quite apply when you're a physician. And so, are we talking about high-level stuff? Most definitely. Are we talking about things that are important to all clinicians? Yes. And so if you are not a PA or an NP, but you work in emergency medicine, I think you will benefit greatly from listening to our podcast, because we, in addition to us being stellar co-hosts, we also have great guests that have come on. And so Ken Milne has come on from the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, a great friend of this podcast, Total EM. Our next co-host, or I guess third host, will be James Roberts, okay, the Roberts of Roberts and Hedges. And it's in that episode where I give Chip that shout out for sending me that metronome article here. So yeah, thank you, Chip, for coming in a pinch and helping me find that article. Didn't think it was out there. So that podcast that I do with Martha Roberts, nurse practitioner here, is called The TwoView. It is on all the big directories now, you know, your Google and your Spotify and your Apple. What you have to do is search for TwoView Emergency. That's the number 2View Emergency. Our website is the number 2. So it's twoview.fireside.fm. And we have show notes there. So if you're in your podcatcher, go ahead and search for TwoView Emergency. Hit subscribe, and we'd love to have you listen. And of course, give us feedback on our podcast. And thank you, Chip, for letting me, number one, just to come on again to Total EM. It's always a real thrill to do that and to chat with you. Your time that you give me today has been a real treasure, and I value it greatly. And also to give a plug for our new effort here that I think is going to help a lot of people. And we're getting some great feedback already.
Awesome. Well, Mike, as always, it seems like we're right around an hour's mark because we like to talk, but I think this was a really important one to go through all that information. So why don't we wrap this up here? Can you give us the tagline?
Until next time, continue to provide high quality CPR, early defibrillation, and total care everywhere.